Welcome to 5-Minute Journal Club. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Today visiting with Dr. Seth Wander from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston to discuss several papers on the use of oral SERDs, selective estrogen receptor degraders, with one elacestrant now approved and others on the way. To begin, I asked Dr. Wander about a paper in the Journal of Clinical Oncology putting forth another ASCO guideline in breast cancer treatment, this one very specifically related to the biomarker-based approval of the SERD elacestrant in patients with ESR1 tumor mutations, as commented on by Dr. Wander.
In the aftermath of the EMERALD study and the resulting FDA approval for hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer patients who have the ESR1 mutation, we really saw an important need to change these guidelines so that we are better directing our clinical partners throughout the country and in the community to think about when to test. What the team said was that they recommended routine testing for emergence of ESR1 mutations at recurrence or progression on endocrine therapy with or without a CDK inhibitor in patients with HER2-negative ER-positive metastatic disease. Now, the important part here is patients whose tumor or ctDNA tests remain ESR1 wild type might warrant retesting at subsequent progression to determine if an ESR1 mutation has arisen. And what's built into this is the realization that when you look at primary tumors, for example, based on TCGA samples, or de novo metastatic tumors, first-line metastatic, that have not yet received endocrine therapy, typically an aromatase inhibitor, we see very low rates of ESR1 alterations, less than probably on the order of 2-3%, which means if a clinician sequences a patient, either the solid tumor or liquid assay, at the time of metastatic diagnosis, there's a relatively low rate of ESR1 alterations, unless they had a lot of aromatase inhibitor and progressed recently in the adjuvant setting. And if you don't test that patient again, for example, 6 months, 12 months, 2 years later, when they progress on first-line metastatic therapy, you might miss the emergence, the acquisition of the ESR1 alteration. And that's really what these guidelines are designed to address. The challenge many of us are now confronting in clinic, what happens if somebody progresses on first-line therapy, you repeat their circulating tumor DNA, and they have concurrent alterations in, for example, ESR1 and PIK3CA, ESR1 and AKT. And this is an unexplored area.
We submitted an abstract to San Antonio on a program where we tested out on oncologists, looking at what people do in various situations and what investigators do. I was surprised by what we found when we asked investigators what they do when they're both mutated. What do you do?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and important practical question that every single oncologist who's watching this video and treats breast cancer is going to run into this, you know, either tomorrow in clinic or in the next couple of weeks. I can take both sides of this argument, Neil. So I'm gonna play devil's advocate and take both sides. So the biology side of things, from my perspective, is the PI3 kinase pathway in particular. Here you have an oncogenic driver target, whether it be PI3 kinase, whether it be AKT. So by that logic, you're hitting the oncogenic driver. You have perhaps a greater magnitude of clinical benefit in the ITT populations. The other argument is, in the right patient who did maybe 2 years, 3 years on prior endocrine CDK inhibitor therapy, indolent bone-only disease, clearly, I think everybody would agree the elacestrant is easier to take. It's less toxic. Patients could derive, you know, prolonged, meaningful clinical benefit from that. Why not use your less toxic therapy first and then think about targeting the oncogenic driver second? So I'll bet in your data that you saw more elacestrant use here than, for example, PI3K pathway use. But in part, it depends a little bit on who you're asking and a little bit on the phrasing of the question.
So actually, it's pretty interesting. Our way of doing guidelines is we ask people what they do, and if they all say the same thing, we call it a consensus.
Right.
This surprised me a lot because I expected people to say SERDs. 50-50, both investigators and community docs. 50-50, which really surprised me. Yeah. I'm sure it has to. If we had broken it down into the type of case, it would have flowed out the way you said, though. I think that's the way they were thinking about it.
And I sort of fall on both sides of that in clinic when I see these patients.
The second paper from our journal club is one of many flooding the meetings and journals, taking a real-world look at the use of SERDs in clinical practice.
This is an effort from our team led by Dr. Max Lloyd in collaboration with our friends over at the Guardant Real World Database, where we wanted to look after the approval of elacestrant at real world patterns of use for this drug. And I actually think this is a really important study. It's the first evidence of elacestrant deployment and activity outside of the prospective clinical trials. Here, we were able to identify just, you know, relatively recently after the approval, over 400 patients in their clinical genomic database who received elacestrant. Only 12% of the patients were second line. About 30% of the patients were either second or third line, and the rest of the patients were fourth or fifth line or later. There was a lot of prior exposure to aromatase inhibitors, CDK inhibitors. About half of the patients had prior chemotherapy exposure, and about two-thirds had prior fulvestrant. And one of the really impressive outcomes here was that the real-world time to discontinuation or time to next treatment, which are validated surrogates for progression-free survival in a clinical trial, were actually quite good. They were on the order of 5 to 6 months, even in this heavily pretreated cohort, even in patients who had three or more prior lines of therapy. I will say that we are actively working on this project right now. This was the kind of first half of the story. We presented it at ASCO in 2024. We're really excited to be working on this project with our colleagues at Guardant. And I think that this will show some really important insights into how this drug is being used and what sort of molecular factors in the real world might correlate with response.
What about this editorial you wrote with Aditi Bardia? It kind of seems related to this paper.
This was an editorial that I wrote with Dr. Bardia highlighting some of the tools that we've been using and others have been using to look at these translational genomic biomarkers. And one of the things that we presented here was the concept that there are many different ways to assess these problems. You can have clinical trial populations. You can have institutional clinical databases at your institution or at other institutions, and you can have these large real-world clinical genomic databases, typically based on claims data, where we have huge patient populations linked to different therapeutic exposures. And we highlight in the article how each of these approaches has sort of complementary strengths and weaknesses, both in terms of the size of the population, how much clinical detail and annotation we have, how heterogeneous the population might be and how well it might reflect what you see in your current clinical practice, as well as how we acquire those patients, either prospectively or retrospectively. So for example, a clinical trial biomarker cohort typically has an intermediate sample size. The degree of clinical insight into what happens to each patient is moderate. The heterogeneity is minimal because these are clinical trials with very strict inclusion criteria, but it's acquired prospectively moving forward in time. Compare that to an institutional database where the sample sizes tend to be small, but we have really deep clinical annotation because these are our patients that we're treating. We can go into the record with a fine-tooth comb and see everything that happened to each patient. Compare that to the large clinical genomic databases. These are by far the biggest sample sizes, into the thousands, tens of thousands of patients, but the degree of clinical annotation is very limited because it's typically linked automatically to claims data. And the heterogeneity is very significant because this is across the entire US, sometimes outside of the US, looking at patients that are getting any sort of genomic testing. So we highlighted this simply to say all of these things can be complementary, and we should be leveraging all of them. When you find a signal that exists across all of these resources, and then you can go into the laboratory and validate that, in my opinion, that's really the strongest potential evidence that that's a real signal and a real impact.
The last paper I want to ask you about is this one looking at ctDNA in patients on imlunestrant in a phase one study in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease and progression on prior endocrine treatment, including CDK4/6 inhibitor. This is all a prelude to the phase 3 EMBER-3 trial currently ongoing. But one of the key questions here was whether the decreases in allele fraction of target biomarkers seen on ctDNA would correlate with treatment benefit, which of course was seen in almost half, like 43% of the patients. Any thoughts?
I want to just highlight a few things. Number one, in this fairly heavily pretreated cohort, the vast majority of patients had detectable ctDNA at baseline, 90% of the patients, okay? And number two, the landscape of resistance here looks a lot like what we would expect it to look like based upon efforts in the laboratory from a variety of teams over the last 5 to 10 years, just looking at the landscape of genetic alterations. We see PIK3CA occurring right at the appropriate level of about 40%. We see P10 and AKT alterations happening in the kind of 5 to 10% range. So 90% of these patients had detectable ctDNA at baseline. The landscape reflected what we know about the hormone receptor positive advanced population. Common alterations did not significantly impact clinical benefit rate, which would mean ESR1, PIK3CA, right? These patients still did okay on the imlunestrant. Patients who achieved a deep molecular response, meaning their allelic fraction dropped by at least 50%, had better progression-free survival. So you're seeing in this, in the overall burden of ctDNA, those who clear their ctDNA or those who drop their ctDNA substantially do better, which makes sense because ctDNA is sort of a tumor marker, right? It's a next generation surrogate of tumor burden. And that these findings, as I mentioned, are being explored not just in EMBER-3 for imlunestrant, but across the board for these next generation anti-estrogen drugs in phase 2 and phase 3 prospective settings.